Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, as we near the end of the regular season, we know what these teams are for the most part. We still have some questions heading into postseason play. So we take a look at the Western Conference today. What are some of the biggest questions or thought bubbles that we have around the top six in the West? After that, we shift to the W side. Angel Reese is a member of the Atlanta Dream. The Washington Mystics, no longer GM. We got stars returning to their squads. We just had an expansion draft with two totally new rosters now. Steve and I react to all of the latest news in the W. We're going to have a good time. Let's have some fun. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, long time no see. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. The basketball's good. Basketball's good. It's hot and ready. Tastes fine. We are getting close to the playoffs, and it's time to ask some questions, guys.
There we go. NBA basketball is really good. We don't have someone in your ear telling you it's not.
No.
Fair enough. But as you alluded to, Steve, we have some questions as we get to the tail end of this regular season. Everyone's played 70-plus games. We have a pretty solid feel of what these teams are good at, what they may not be as good at, some things that are some high variance levels. And so for today, we want to talk about the West playoff teams, your top six right now. And we wanted to get into our biggest questions about these teams heading into the postseason. Now, the fun part of this exercise for me is, you know, Steve and I are obviously watching these teams throughout the year. There are things that I worry about more heavily than Steve does. There are things that Steve worries about more heavily than I do. And so it's cool to kind of mind meld a little bit, just kind of check in, see where both of us are. So I'm excited to see where this conversation goes and what we are, quote unquote, worried about or thinking about heading into the playoffs. So we're going to start with the Oklahoma City Thunder, top of the standings right now. 62-16, percolating in the glass, sixth in offense, first in defense, still first in net rating, better than plus 12 per 100 possessions on that front. For me, Steve, the obvious one is health, like who's going to be there and thus what the rotation is going to be. But I think the thing that I've been thinking the most about with this Thunder group, it's loosely related to Shea, but it's more of a coaching thing. I'm curious to see how Mark Daigneault handles the Lou Dort, Cason Wallace, Alex Caruso triumvirate in a playoff setting. Because we know what all three of those guys could do defensively. Lou Dort still takes on your number ones. Cason Wallace can do it too, and he's played at an all-defense level. Alex Caruso is an absolute madman that can defend a little bit of everyone. But on the other end, as we saw in last year's playoffs, as we've seen during this regular season, and especially in some marquee matchups, teams are getting more and more comfortable and more audacious with how aggressively they're helping off those guys from the three-point line. Is this a new problem that the Thunder have never faced before? Absolutely not. But for a team that has won 62 games amid all kinds of injury things, I know they're very good. They just won a championship last year. And so for me, as the Thunder have like recently added Jared McCain, you have Isaiah Joe, you have other shooters, I'm just curious to see what the hook is going to be like once we get to the playoffs. If we get more teams being willing to say we are putting a big on Lou Dort, like the Nuggets have done with Nikola Jokic, we're going to put a big or our best off-ball defender on Cason Wallace or Alex Caruso so we can roam around and muck things up. The half-court offense for OKC has been very good overall this year, but in their worst moments, the spacing gets cramped. We are sending even more bodies and more attention to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We're cross-matching in a way that can turn some of the Shai-Chet things into switches. And then we're still helping off of the non-shooters. So, like, how much grace does Mark Daigneault give Dort, Wallace, Caruso with how teams treat them and try to muck things up for Shai and, to a lesser degree, Chet, is probably the biggest question I have heading into the postseason with OKC.
Well, I think it's an interesting question, but I think it kind of ties into the Oklahoma City ethos to a degree. And they're the standard for a reason because of how they've built this as far as having different combinations, being able to throw different lineups out there, feeling like they can navigate with their versatility throughout different matchups within the playoffs. And so when you listen to Mark Daigneault talk, you know, he's always talking about trying to learn the lessons from wins and losses, get to the next one. Do what we do, build our muscles, and then flex it. And I think last year, you know, when he was talking about expanding the rotation throughout the playoffs, like usually most coaches, most teams are trying to shorten the rotation. Here are our guys that are going to play. it may change one or two, depending on the series. And he was like, no, we're going to just make sure we have the optionality. That's why you get AJ Mitchell in the finals last year. You know, wasn't a massive stint, but he got a swing at the bat. So I think, is it going to be a hook, or is it going to be, we need this, I know this lineup can produce that, we're going to be good to go? I think when you talk about that triumvirate, they're all going to be very important to Oklahoma City's playoff success. And I think the most important thing for OKC is being able to play around them and being able to shuffle them and not having to play all three of them at the same time. And so being able to have two of them on the court at the same time, one of them on the court at the same time, so we can go double big. We can have two defensive demons on the court. We can kind of put ourselves in different positions and shuffle the deck a little bit. You know, Caruso not having to snart, coming in and just deciding, actually, I'm just going to cause chaos, has an impact. Cason Wallace's pressure defensively, full court, has an impact in his growth offensively. Lou Dort, you can have the maligned conversation about him all you want. Tends to make timely baskets in the playoffs, going to defend the top player, knows his assignment, going to get it done. So they have an understanding of who they are, and it's surrounded by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And so I think for me, I'm intrigued to see how do teams treat Shai this playoff run, because he's been so good in so many different ways. Scoring the basketball is one thing, right? We've talked about it ad nauseum this year, as far as I can get whatever bucket I want. I've added the step back three, pull up three, where, hey, you weren't expecting this, and now it hurts, and I'm setting my drive back up, I can get to my mid-range, I'm in command of what I want to do, and the playmaking has grown. And so, for me, in the back of my brain, do teams respect the playmaking growth and hesitate as far as how much help and when they double, or do they lean the other direction and say, actually, you've got it going a little bit, anyone but you? And what does that open up for OKC? So I think there is a little bit of a Shai element.
No, I think that's fair. And like, not to spoil too much on the Shai MVP piece that I have coming out later this week, one of the things I was looking at with Shai, getting into like some of the clutch numbers in particular, is like how exactly he's being guarded. Because it's very easy to sort, like, he's leading NBA in clutch points, et cetera. But like, you look at the ball screens that he's been running in clutch situations, and it's like a blitz rate flirting with 17%, which is like easily the highest mark in the league among high volume ballers. Like, teams have largely said, when it matters, anybody but you. And it's been fun watching Shai kind of navigate, okay, you're giving me two on the ball, here's an easy pass, y'all can play out of that. And also, y'all are trying to send two. I'm going to reject this or split this. I'm going to get to my spot anyway, and I'm going to do some sort of subtle emote on the way back after I just scored another basket. And so
Hold on. Unless you're a certain player who has annoyed me, then I'm going to make sure it's a Fortnite emote that I display very quickly.
Yeah. I think he's had quite a few of those post All-Star break in particular. But yeah, so that's where I'm like, again, like, do I have questions about Shai per se? Like, not really. Like, knock down your jumpers when you get to those step back and sidestep threes. I would like to see that success maintained, like we've seen it in the regular season. So like, there's that. But that's why I kind of start with like Dort, Wallace, Caruso, and some of the other guys, because they need that defense. And like, part of the Shai MVP case is like, we can play these defensively slanted lineups and still score at a high clip because this dude is insane. And to your point, the playmaking has also jumped up. But there's such a downstream effect if that goes haywire. If teams are able to, you can't really stop Shai. He doesn't need to get all the way to the rim because of how good of a mid-range scorer he is. But if it is impacting the overall shot profile and the overall flow of this offense, then Mark Datnote has options. But then what is the trade-off there? Like, okay, cool. Lou Dort is having one of those. It's a 1 of 8. He's taking early clock threes and missing, being a little handsy defensively. The whistle's tighter in this particular game. Okay, we need more Isaiah Joe. We need more Jarrett McCain. Okay, that loosens up the court a little bit for Shai. But now teams are like, cool, we know who we are putting in action when we get to the other side of the ball. And like, how does OKC navigate that portion? Again, they just won a championship. So like, is my concern level a 10? No. But that's kind of where my brain is at right now. Like, what does that do for which wing players are playing? What does that do for single big versus double big, as you alluded to earlier? That's kind of where I'm at.
Again, the fact they have all three of those is like, oh, okay, I'm going to let you sit with me for a little bit, and I'm going to let this person do what you're supposed to do, and then you can get another shot at it. Don't worry about it. I'm glad you mentioned the bigs, because my eyes go to the big man room very quickly to see, is this the year that a team can get to their bigs? Can we make the double big lineup feel uncomfortable? Can we make when Mark Dadnall goes small feel like I need to react as opposed to I'm doing this from a position of strength? Can we attack Isaiah Hartenstein, who has decided, hey, if you are trying to dunk on me, that's a bad idea. I'm going to block that. And Chet Holmgren, who has been able to switch and rotate and be very active and protect for him as well. Can a team get to those two? Can a team poke at Chet on the offensive end when OKC's on offense and say, hey, you know what? We're going to put a wing on you. You can't necessarily drive. You're not going to have the same looks. You're switching pick and roll. You got a space. That's where I think it gets interesting. To me, I said last year, no one really accomplished the full goal, but I feel like if you can poke at those bigs and make it a little uncomfortable, you put OKC in a little bit more of a reactive state, you can kind of open things up. The issue is, boy, not a lot of teams have been able to knock on that door. So is this the year someone figures something out?
I think that is a fair question. I feel like on this podcast in particular, we've been talking a lot about, hey, Chet, you're seeing a lot of switches. You're seeing a lot of wings. How often are you winning these matchups? And on the nights that it goes well, it's like, well, there's not really much you can do with OKC. They're scoring well enough, or they're just scoring at a high clip in the half court, which means they get to set this defense and you're just not going to have a good time. On the nights that Chet doesn't have it, though, they still can win because they are very good, headlined by their MVP. But it does put a little bit of friction in that offense. And so I like Chet at the five in particular, because long-term view, you're kind of waiting on that to just kind of be OKC's default as they get closer to some pretty tough financial decisions. Like, they're going to have to decide, are we bringing, how long are we going to have Hartenstein here? What are we going to do with this Lu Dort contract? We got to pay Cason Wallace soon. These maxes for Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren, like, they're about to start kicking in slash just getting larger in terms of salary allocation. Chet has to solve a lot. I feel like it's kind of similar to conversations we've had with Karl-Anthony Towns, where like when he gets to be a five offensively, it's just an entirely different dynamic than when he is kind of either literally playing the four alongside Isaiah Hartenstein, or with the way that defenses match up, he just becomes a four by default. And so winning those are still going to be pretty important. I'm also intrigued to see what that looks like and how OKC forms their lineups around Chet to kind of make life easier for him, especially in the minutes that he's on the floor without Shea. I think that's when you can get more ownership of the offense for him. That's where you hope the drives and the mid-range scoring in particular continues to pop for Chet in ways that they have this year. So I think that's a fair thing to bring up, Steve. I think that's fair. Can I drop one quick or two quick stat nuggets for you while we're here?
Very quickly, yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Because we do indeed have the move. I think, one, circling back to the role player shooting, 35% from three in wins with Caruso, Dorton, and Cason, 29% from three in losses between those two. And then looking at the big man stats, plus 13 net rating with Chet on the floor without Isaiah Hartenstein, plus 7 net rating with Isaiah Hartenstein on the floor without Chet, a plus 20.6 net rating with Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein on the court together. Again, both of those guys have missed time with injury and things, but just to highlight what you said earlier, yeah, teams haven't really had fun dealing with those two. But
no, now move to. But should we talk to the team that people may have the most questions about? The other 60-win team in the Western Conference, the San Antonio Spurs, who, look, you can, not a lot of people thought they would do this. I was watching the Denver game when they said, hey, they got a chance to get their 60th win. I was like, wait a minute, what do you mean? I knew they were very good, but 60 wins? Huh? What are we talking about here? It gets interesting because I feel like this is, and every team gets the playoff experience tag. I loved Victor Wembanyama's answer when asked about it, as far as just saying, all right, we're going to go for it no matter what. So what? We don't have the experience. He plays that way. That team plays that way. I think if you break down the playoff experience point, I think it splits into two different things for me and my two questions. Will your defense be able to have the same impact late in games in the playoffs, considering you are going to be in a position to face players and teams who can just kind of take whatever your scheme is and throw it over the top rope? So we've talked about the effort from the San Antonio guards as far as their ability to be active and contain penetration and their ability to rotate around Wimby and Wimby's ability to have a command of the defense and say, hey, I'm going to rotate. I'm going to get to the block. We're going to fly around me and I'll protect you. Teams don't want to put Wimby in action, right? There's all of that. And you feel that over the course of the game. In a fourth quarter, okay, Nikola Jokic says, actually, Wimby, let's dance. Well, me and Jamal Murray are going to be in action together. How do you want to guard that? Anthony Edwards is the type of person, I don't really care about your scheme. I'm going to attack someone. Kevin Durant, like LeBron. Like there are players who can just kind of get these kind of shots where, yeah, it's cool that you have the help. You're not in this action, and I'm not going all the way to the basket. So the weight that we've carried for three quarters, do we not feel as much in the fourth? It's something that had popped in my brain. And then offensively, what do you want to get to in crunch time? This is a team that has done a great job offensively of just being the next play team. You score, get the ball at the net, we get it up the floor, we play. Guard play is consistently on the floor. We attack, we get in the paint touches, drive and kick, force more help, make the extra play. Not exactly the brand of Spurs basketball that people expect, but it's similar in nature as far as we're just going to keep pressure on you. Everyone knows the assignment. Everyone knows their job. What's the pressure point late in games? Victor Wembanyama has grown as far as his offense, as far as being aggressive, looking to drive more, mixing in threes, ceiling, posting up. They have De'Aaron Fox. We know what Stephon Castle has done. His growth has been great as far as his playmaking, getting in the paint, being able to have patience and reject. But what are you tapping late in games? Because Victor Wembanyama is the one type of player that Wimby has taken off the map is your small guard. Do not switch that man onto me because I'm going to do bad things. That's off the table. But, okay, we put a wing on Wimby. What's those catches look like? We switch. De'Aaron Fox, what are you prepared to do? Stephon Castle, what's your aggression level? So do they have the thing that's going to force a defense to say, we have to send help. We have to send a double. And now, because it's the fourth quarter, all that flow we see in the first three quarters, is it now we're starting slower. We're into one option. We're now hoping De'Aaron Fox makes a pull up. We're not still keeping the same pressure on you. Those flare screens are cute, but we're not doing it in the fourth quarter. So can they elevate that portion of the game? Those are probably the two questions I have for San Antonio.
No, I think that is fair. I think quickly to the offense, particularly the clutch offense, the Spurs on the year 24-12 in clutch games, which a team that doesn't have playoff experience yet, et cetera, pretty good track record that they're building in terms of we get the crunch time, we're able to win these games. Looking at the offense in particular, in wins, second best offensive rating in the clutch. In losses, 28th. To your point, I think it can get a little bit haywire in terms of where these touches are going, how we're getting to them, the tempo in which we're getting to them, and as you allude to, some of the cross-matching that they have to face now to where we can push some of these Wimby catches out, we can turn more of these pick and rolls into switches, depending on who else is on the floor, which was one of the quieter things that intrigued me during that Spurs-Nuggets game, which was just awesome, by the way. It's like, okay, you got Keldon Johnson in the game, and Jokic's like, yeah, that's fine. I'm stay down here while he's in the corner. It's like, Keldon can kind of shoot. It's kind of weird that he's getting this coverage because he can knock down corner threes and he can also drive and put you underneath the basket. He did win some of those. I was like, okay, if teams are feeling more comfortable with, yeah, that's Julian Champagne in the corner, we'll still keep our big here. Yeah, that's Keldon Johnson, we'll still keep our big here. With Stephon Castle as well as he's played, it kind of flows to my biggest question with San Antonio. We are comfortable throwing different looks at him in an effort to muck things up for him and to also muck things up from Wimby. I'm intrigued with what this late offense is going to be like. Because, like, even zooming out with the Spurs this year, am I surprised that they are an elite defense? No, because when Wimby was on the floor as a rookie, they defended at an elite level. They continue to do so when he is there. And now we've had the healthiest version of Victor Wembanyama so far this year, which I guess, ironically, I'll quickly note, did leave the Sixers game with a rib contusion. So we'll see how long he's going to be out there. Hopefully he's okay. Like, we've been able to build this boat. The offense has always performed at a high level pretty much all year, but I've always kind of looked at it like, I like the flares. Wimby's obviously growing. Like, I feel like there are some things you can poke at here. And so I think that's a fair thing to bring up, Steve. And I'll just quickly say, to the Castle point, as someone that has seen a bunch of unders throughout his NBA career and has still seen a bunch of unders this year, as teams have felt comfortable at times saying, we're just going to put our big on you, let's see what you do about it, to Castle's credit, he has largely said, yeah, I've seen this before. Cutting, I can still get downhill with the drives, I can still boogie and pick and roll. And then later in possessions, if I don't have the ball, I'm in the darker spot and I'm still mucking things up with offensive rebounds and things. He has won those challenges. But in the playoffs, it is a different deal to where you can get even more granular and more specific about how and when we want to help off of him. And so from a competitive standpoint, do I think Stephon Castle is going to be ready for the postseason? Absolutely. In terms of execution, I do want to see what this is going to look like in a playoff setting. If he nails it, the Spurs can beat anyone, as we've seen throughout this regular season. So that's where I am at with the San Antonio Spurs. Finally, Steve, the 3 seed in the Western Conference as of recording, just moved to 3. The Denver Nuggets on a pretty big win. I think it's 9 wins in a row right now for the Denver Nuggets. Some nice reminder wins as of late, particularly that win over the San Antonio Spurs where Nikola Jokic lost his mind to close out that basketball game. My biggest question with Denver, one, naturally, surrounds the defense, which first in offensive rating, third best offensive rating of all time right now, by the way. 21st in defensive rating. A lot of injury context to add in, of course. But that has been the biggest issue with the Denver Nuggets throughout this season. When the defensive effort is there, like it was the first month or so of the season, we're like, holy crap, this is an elite offense and like a top 5 defense. Watch out, OKC. When it ain't that, it's been bad. And so on a basic level, what is the defensive aptitude going to be for this group in a postseason setting? And as we've both been kind of alluding to this year, and you in particular, Steve, have been hitting on with the Nuggets this year, they have tried so many different things this year. How many of those things are they actually going to be able to execute at a high level once we get into the postseason?
I think it ties hand in hand. And so I think part of the discomfort, if you're a Nuggets fan, is that we have not had the home run swing that we usually have that carries the rest of what we're struggling with, right? And so we're trying to figure it out. On the flip side, the underrated part of this Denver Nuggets season, this Denver Nuggets team, is they are just willing to try different things. They will shuffle the deck. And so, hey, here's some zone. Here's Nikola Jokic on a non-shooter. Here's a small lineup where we're switching everything. Here's some more cross-matching. Here's us doubling because we don't want you to hit this. Like, we may not trap all the time, pick and roll, but we might be at the level. Like, there's an element of being able to kind of just turn the wheel and being willing to, in a sense that we're not necessarily bending. We're just trying to get you out of rhythm and trying to find something that works and then stick with that. And if that doesn't work, we'll go to something else. And it works for, I think, this Denver team because you have to deal with them in the fourth quarter in a way that I think people can forget. Like, yeah, Nikola Jokic, put a wing on him, make him a switch. Does he want to score? That sounds very good till you get to the fourth quarter or the third quarter. And Nikola Jokic has established, yes, I would like to score. And now, you know, who's guarding Aaron Gordon? Is Aaron Gordon now a screener for Jamal Murray? We know they want to put those three in actions together. So how comfortable do you get in those fourth quarter moments? And I think for Denver, you would like to have, to your point, this is the one scheme that we do. But I think if we've watched this Denver Nuggets team, there have been times where we're like, ooh, they're not rotating. The defense is this. They're going to have to figure it out. They're going to have a tough time. when those moments happen, actually, we're not going to do that anymore. Scrap that. We'll flip to something else. See if that works. Mm-hmm. Get us back in rhythm. And so can that have a more positive impact in a playoff series where you are more familiar with a team as the series goes on? Potentially. But I think there is some value to having more options in your back pocket than purely, boy, I hope this works.
No, I think that's fair. And like, that's where my question becomes like, okay, how many of these things can you do? Because I was excited headed into the year. Like, I know we're going to see more zone. We already saw some of the Jokic cross magic in the playoffs under David Adelman. So we're going to get a higher volume of that. It's going to be neat. And for me, watching this Nuggets group, I've been trying to balance, okay, they're going to more zone, but a lot of these nights, the zone is kind of getting dinged a little bit. Or at the very least, teams are finding ways to poke at, y'all are going 2-3. Jokic is in the corner instead of being in the middle of this thing. We cade and cut through and set up pin-ins, and we can generate shots. It's like, I don't love that teams, even if they're missing the shots, I don't love that teams are kind of figuring that kind of stuff out. And so just I'm like balancing that with also, even with their base coverages, yeah, this doesn't look great. Jokic needs to be better in some areas, but also, like, they haven't had Christian Brown. They haven't had Peyton Watson. They're asking Bruce Brown to do a lot when he comes off the bench. They're asking some of these guys to just take on tougher assignments than you would anticipate. It's like, how much grace do I give for that part versus, okay, this still just isn't working on this night that I'm watching the Nuggets or whatever the case may be. And so that's where, like, I'm glad that they have reps with all these things, but I like actual, like, what is looking like when Jokic is at the level, what are they doing? When Jokic didn't drop, what are they doing? When the Nuggets are in zone, what are they doing? Yeah, I look at some of those numbers, and again, looking through those films, like, I would like to feel better about each of these individual things so that not only do they have it in the back pocket, I feel confident in what they have in their back pocket. So I'm just curious to see what it looks like. Nah, but because their offense is so good and because Jokic is that good, like, it only needs to hit a certain level for it to matter. So
survival mode doesn't feel great. Before we get out of here, it ties into mine. Like, can you get the attempts of that versatility to pay off in the playoffs? And then, hey, which lineups are going to hit during different series? Jonas Valanciunas will help. Which time will he help? Are we just at small ball Aaron Gordon at five? When will that be the thing? Can we hit the right combination at the right time? Those are going to be important for Denver. But they are a dangerous team if, of course, the health thing that we addressed but didn't address because, yeah, they need that. They need that.
They very much need that. And we need you to stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we talk about seeds 4-6 in the Western Conference and some of the questions that we have. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot, continuing our questions for Western Conference playoff teams, at least as of recording, because the standings are still going to shift quite a bit over the next few days. We now go to the four seed, Steve. The Los Angeles Lakers, or more accurately, what is left of the Los Angeles Lakers right now? 50 and 28, 9th in offense, 19th in defense, 14th in net rating. Luka Doncic, hamstring injury suffered during an Oklahoma City Thunder beatdown. Do not know when he's going to return. Do not know what his award eligibility is, but more importantly, do not know when he's going to return and what that means for the Lakers in the postseason. Austin Reeves, oblique injury, might be out 4 to 6 weeks, would certainly put his postseason in peril, or at least the opening round of the postseason in peril, if we don't get any sort of quick fix there. Don't know when he's going to be back. And so the obvious question surrounding the Los Angeles Lakers is, how do you survive without two of your three best players this late entering the postseason? More specifically for me, Steve, obviously a lot more responsibility is going to be put on LeBron James, who against the Dallas Mavericks, 30 points, 9 rebounds, 15 assists. We know he still has some of those still left in him, but 38 minutes for LeBron James. And for me, he's kind of tracking, okay, what is the on-ball responsibility going to be like for him? A season high, I think 113 touches for him in that game. That was his first year with a game over 100 touches. His previous high was 91. So if you want to talk about a ramp up, that was certainly it. But tied to that, Steve, what do the Lakers look like when LeBron has to go to the bench? Where does the creation come from when LeBron James is not on the floor? Because the previous answer was some variation of Luka Doncic and or Austin Reeves. Now when LeBron sits, and Marcus Smart's still out right now, who's doing the creating? What does the tempo look like? Do you just want to be a we switch and mug this up, and we just play defense, and we just try to score as much as we can in transition, just hold serve? Can we generate three-point looks without teams just saying, we're switching all of that because we don't care about y'all off the bounce? The non-LeBron minutes are really in focus for me with the Lakers while their other two stars are out.
I mean, this is where the saga of DeAndre Ayton gets real interesting, as far as if you recall, hey, I'm not that. Actually, I'm going to look in the mirror. I am that. And then everyone's gone. He played 19 minutes against the Mavericks. And it's like, would you like to scale him up to a degree and be able to use him in pick and roll and see if that's something that you can explore some more options? But this late in the season, with what Luka has been doing, you know, we've talked about it, with Austin Reeves' growth, that's a big blow because it's like, okay, where do we pivot to? Like, obviously, Luke Kennard is going to be a big part of it. But, okay, we can use him in movement. He can get downhill. He can make plays. But, okay, what do we want to do philosophically? Our team switching against non-LeBron lineups, that's going to hurt us in a different way. So I think it's just like, okay, can we focus on the defensive end? Can we really grind and make things muddy and attack on the other end? I think that's probably where you go there. I mean, my thing is like, how do you, it's a really tough blow for the Lakers timing wise, because they, I felt like they are really scratching and knocking on the door. If you're a coach, it's like, boy, this is a real tough thing. I'd like to go out on, you know, wearing my armor and fall down knowing we didn't have, I didn't get it done as far as not having enough. I mean, I think it's got to be Rui, like Rui's self-creation. You're going to need Jake LaRavia and Luke Kennard movement. You're going to have to be able to find a roller. So you're going to have to hope that a team is not going to switch and we can get some sort of role and create and skip and play out of that. But I think for the Lakers, for this team to have success without their Luka and Austin Reeves, you got to find a way to scale a defense up even more very quickly. Find a playoff game plan, make it gross. LeBron is LeBron still, and he will command attention. He will make the plays, make the right reads, read the game, mind the game even. And I hope you can kind of make it tough. The grit and grind Lakers, or the grit and grind Lagoons, who knows?
Wow. Did not know where that was going to end. Can I just quickly add, because you mentioned Luke Kennard. One, if you get 100 guesses of players in the non-star division that would give you a 15, 16, and 11 game at the season, I don't know if Luke Kennard would have been very high on that list. So I want to salute him for being able to put together that type of, not just a triple-double, but that type of triple-double in the midst of a poor shooting night. Also interesting with Luke Kennard in this basketball game, which is tied to a larger Luke Kennard thing that's been a theme for most of his career. Like, one, he took 12 shots inside the arc. Like, that's just not the Luke Kennard bit. Only 5 threes. Like, some of that's going to be coverage-driven. But Luke Kennard, as we've gotten closer to playoff time across multiple spots, has been, this guy can shoot the leather off the ball. In a literal sense, the Lakers cannot afford for Luke Kennard to be a tentative shooter. Because we know, in terms of the actual ability, he's one of the best that we have in the NBA. He's just going to have to get comfortable taking some contested threes during this stretch. They just need his volume, especially if he's on the floor without LeBron for any stretch. So I'm curious to see what that part is going to look like and if he's able to kind of battle some historical trends for him.
Well, real quick, you're correct there, but I want to give a quick shout out to Fast Break Breakfast, who delivered the tweet saying Luke Kennard now has a higher single game career high for rebounds than Jaren Jackson Jr. And that sentence rattled in my brain for a good 5 minutes.
Oh dear.
So what do you want to talk about? What do you want to talk about?
You know, Steve, I thought that we were going, I just hope we eventually learn from Brooke Lopez to where, like, hey, if our team rebounds, it doesn't matter how many I grab individually. I want us to get to that place as a basketball community.
Oh, I thought we were going to the next team.
We are going to the next team. You know, a good rebounding team at that. We'll stick with the theme. The Houston Rockets, currently in 5. Offense, 4th in defense, 6th in net rating on the year. And my biggest question surrounding the Houston Rockets revolves around their young guys, or their most important young guys moving forward, I would say. And simply, I have in my notes, are Reed Shepherd and Amen Thompson ready for this level of responsibility? Reed Shepherd's been in the starting lineup as of late. We know what he can do in pick and roll. We know what his spacing can unlock, what his relocations can unlock whenever Alperen Şengün or Kevin Durant gets 2 on the ball. I think not just his passing ability, but the audaciousness of his passes, I think, gives the Houston Rockets half-court offense a little bit more of a ceiling. It can unlock some cutters and some of the late rolls that they have to deal with against defenses. Amen Thompson, one of the best defenders that we have in the league. He's taken on a lot more on-ball responsibility this year offensively. And I've just been kind of sprinkling. I've said some tweets. I've said this in different areas. I've been kind of keeping an eye. Like, the Amen Thompson that I've been watching in the calendar year of 2026 looks a lot more comfortable navigating inside the arc. It's not just the drives and the finishing. It's not just the dunker spot roaming and getting offensive rebounds. Like, some of the mid-range looks, some of the turnarounds, some of these floaters. He's getting to shots that may not always look aesthetically pleasing, but he's getting to them consistently. It's the same footwork for him. Like, these are shots that he feels comfortable taking. And I think comparing that to what we saw during the first 2 or 3 games of the Golden State series last year, where he was very clearly searching for it, not necessarily do I need to be aggressive, but like, within that aggression, what exactly are shots that I like, especially if I can't get all the way to the rim? I want to see him take the growth that we've seen for him this season, and again, just looking at 2026 onward in particular, I want to see him take that growth and carry that over into the postseason. Because if he can do that, then you can get the on-ball, off-ball blend that I think the Rockets and Rocket fans ultimately want him to have, to where he can do both versus being much better at one than the other. And Reed got to hold up defensively too, but we'll get there. That's where I start with the Rockets.
I mean, funnily enough, Reed Shepard, I feel like, has done his job defensively, and that's half the battle. And for Reed Shepard, if we're talking about him defensively in the playoffs, you just need to do it enough to where they'd be like, or they will be like, let's do something else. That's all he has to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of that, when you talk about the defense, when you've seen kind of what they've been doing recently, it's not new for Houston, but hey, Alperen Şengün, you guard wing or non-shooter. Kevin Durant, you guard big. And now that puts Kevin Durant in a position where he can kind of protect. Now, teams are probably going to put Şengün back in action, so it gets interesting there, but they're trying to find ways to insulate. I think the biggest thing for Amen Thompson and or Reed Shepard is tied into Houston's overall process that we've seen flashes and glimpses of during the stretch, where make quick decisions, get off the ball, push the ball up the court, throw it ahead, and let's get into something. And I think they've had positive growth as far as making quicker decisions, getting off the ball, getting to more off-ball screens. We've seen Kevin Durant set flares from the corner for Reed Shepard. We've seen Amen Thompson as far as being able to be comfortable, not just in the dunker spot, but I can cut, I can set flares. Playing through Alperen Şengün at the elbow gives them a level of movement and flow. It can get a little sticky at times as far as timing goes, but the benefit of it is, hey, we're moving. We have options. And now Alperen Şengün is closer to the basket.
Yes.
He wants to go tween hezzy. And it feels a little bit better when he's at the elbow doing that than when he decides, I would like to gather 2 feet behind the three-point line. Let me cook. I understand the mindset. I don't know if we need that. And I think it ties into one of my questions, like, can they blend all of this together? Do they understand what makes them good? Can you get this going in a solid way consistently? Because I think sometimes when they get in these tight games where everyone gets their phone, their tablet, gets on their laptop and says, Ime Udoka, you, and they say all the words. Okay. At times,
the light my fire.
The players got to understand the assignment. You know what I mean? Don't limit yourself to a one option team. You may not be that. Mm-hmm. Give yourself a chance to explore, make the defense react. If you take 17 seconds to get the ball to Kevin Durant, well, we could stay at home. I don't have to necessarily send this double. But it also ties into how important Kevin Durant is, and can you get teams to put two on the ball against Kevin Durant? How consistent can you do that? Because I think one of the things we've seen over the course of these matchups is Kevin Durant making shots at the start of a game and a team being like, actually, nah,
not you.
We can't do this. And now that opens up two on the ball, Kevin Durant, pocket pass, Şengün, and the Rockets have discovered ball movement. Once again, they have it in them. It's just unlocking it. That's the process for Rockets. And so can they kind of understand what they need to attack, be intentional, and stay consistent with their tempo? I think that's a big one for me.
Got you. I got two things, then we can move to the next team. Questions for you. One, do you have any concerns about the on-ball, off-ball split for Kevin Durant as we enter the postseason setting? Because in terms of ability, like, obviously he can fly off screens and knock down shots or attack in pick and roll. Like, he can create in isolation, he can create. But as we talk about how defenses treat them, when KD's off the ball, we are super physical with them. And as a team that already plays more methodically, if we're super physical with Kevin Durant and he just can't come off some of these, we have burned a bunch of clock and now we got to go to option two and we haven't created anything. And then pick and roll during some of the low moments for Houston this year and then, you know, post All-Star break. Hey, cool. Let's just trap Kevin Durant a bunch and let's see what happens there. And it's like turnover central. And it's like, ooh, well, you don't really want that either. So how do you got to feel about how Houston has managed how much of each they want to do with him?
I mean, I think they've made the attempt. I mean, I think it's hard to deny that when he has it going, he's going to draw attention. He's going to make a defense react. The balance as far as the timeliness of his turnovers has felt very loud. Like, this doesn't feel like, ooh, Kevin Durant's just throwing the ball all over the place. But it does feel like, okay, we're attacking this matchup or we're putting this in action and all right, we're going to get something out of it. And then the turnover happens. It's like, well,
we kind of need
have that right then. And then it's like, okay, we're gonna get into in the post, or get into with the elbow, or get into him off a pin down. And it takes so long, as you mentioned, and so you don't necessarily get the weight. Like, you don't get the payoff, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm less concerned about how much you use him on ball, off ball. I'm more concerned about, can you get the payoff of what you built up? Because he's the person that teams are going to make a decision on, whether they want to double, put two mm-hmm. on the ball, or they want to deny, whatever. Can we leverage that? If we are in a moment where he's played well, we've done our jobs, and now we don't leverage this at the end, that's a tough pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair. Like, it's just, KD brings so much value offensively, period. But, like, there are very loud downsides to both that I kind of worry about in a postseason setting. So it's kind of like, how are they setting up or safeguarding against either one of those popping up in, to your point, like, critical moments? And I think that circles back to how important Reed Shepherd and Amen Thompson and Alperen Sengun can be during this stretch. Like, y'all have the ability to take pressure off of Kevin Durant on a basic sense, but also, I mean, being used together, Sengun screening for KD or he screening for Sengun, oh, we don't have to worry about teams grabbing him in the same way, because we could generate advantages in a different way. We could generate touches in different areas of the floor in a different way. If Reed is handling KD screening, you have to make different decisions. You don't have to worry about the same off-ball grabbiness, or KD now has to dribble against a set defense that's clawing in and poking at the handle. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that. I'll actually save my second question for a later date so we can get to Minnesota, but I definitely wanted to get your thoughts on the Kevin Durant front. Let's move to the current sixth seed, Steve. The Minnesota Timberwolves, as of recording, 46-32, 13th in offense, 6th in defense, 10th in net rating per cleaning the glass. I feel like I have been in a very similar place with the Minnesota Timberwolves for a while. They are a team that, on the high end, I feel like can beat anyone. They have been in back-to-back Western Conference finals. This can be a high-level defense, especially when Rudy Gobert is on the floor. Offensively, we have seen legitimate growth from Anthony Edwards in terms of getting off the ball early or quickly when teams are trying to put two on him. He's diagnosing coverages better. We've seen more growth inside the arc for him in terms of shot profile and things like that. I would like for them, as I have said before, to find a level of consistency on both ends of the floor. And it is concerning to me that we are in early April and we keep getting of the same quote from Chris Finch and others about the seriousness of the group, the attentiveness of the group, the consistency of the group, the energy of the group, the execution of the group. And it's like, hey, man, certainly throwing in a late Anthony Edwards injury, welcome back, and a Jaden McDaniels injury, which really looms large for their playoff hopes. Like, obviously, that does not help. And it makes life more difficult. But from a process perspective, I would like to just see Minnesota playing the right way or playing their brand of basketball more consistently than I have been for what feels like 3 months at this point.
You know, it's getting close to tax day because Nekias has thrown the New York Knicks and the Minnesota Timberwolves over the top rope. That's how you know you need to make sure you hit that deadline. The biggest thing is, well, I mean, every year we get to Nekias in April and he's just like, what if the child has bad vibes? And every time Minnesota responds in a different way. I think the toughest part for Minnesota is that they got hurt.
Is that the baby has bad vibes? You're unserious. Continue with your Wolves thought. Let's go.
Oh. The toughest part for Minnesota is they got hurt at the worst possible time to a degree, to where, okay, we lost Jaden McDaniels, who was a huge part of our defense. And then we also lost Anthony Edwards, who was a huge part of our offense. And you had some moments pre-McDaniels going down where it's, okay, we lock back in our defense, we get some more movement offensively, get some more tempo, we're forced to do some of the things and answer some questions, we're in a good place. He goes down, it's like, well, darn. And so
Julia,
my thing is just like, do they have enough time and or the right matchup to scale back up? The ceiling still feels very high for this Minnesota Timberwolves team. The floor feels a little bit wobbly than in other years, where it's like, okay, we just didn't get in the right position. We haven't had done this. They have all the buttons they can press in a playoff series. It's just, can they find some rhythm and confidence during this end of season stretch to put themselves in position? Because, hey, we'll have some days to gather ourselves, prep for this matchup, and get it going, can they just find themselves down the stretch and make it work?
Well, again, here's the funny thing about this for the Minnesota Timberwolves, that they had, as they need to finish this regular season strong to hopefully move up in the standings, but at the very least, you just want to have some momentum heading in. There is a non-zero chance that they end up facing the Luka-less, Austin Reeves-less Los Angeles Lakers in round one, which would give them an opportunity to kind of reestablish themselves against a team that is just not going to be themselves in round one. And if they get the round two from there, if we're a healthy group, we have ants offensively. Julius Randle can drive and post up and play make. Jaden McDaniels is growing as an offensive player. Dante DiVincenzo will bomb away and make all the hustle plays on both ends of the floor. I want to pause there and ask you a quick free throw. Because we haven't really circled back to this like we have with other players as they switch teams. How have you felt about the Ayo Dosunmu experience in Minnesota since we have a larger sample on it now?
Same way I felt when I saw him when he debuted. He adds a punch to their team. He's able to kind of give them some on-ball juice, attack in transition, can defend multiple positions, so he fits right in with what they do. You just need the Wolves to get back up to the high points so you feel the impact of what Ayo Dosunmu brings a little bit more.
Okay, that's fair. Looking at the numbers that he's had so far in Minnesota, 56% on twos, which quiet subplot of this has been Ayo just experimenting with mid-range jumpers. And again, some quotes like, well, yeah, I couldn't really do that in Chicago. Like, Billy didn't want us to take those shots. I have more freedom to do that now. So, like, him mixing in the pick-and-roll pull-ups has been cool, in addition to the three-point shooting, what he adds to the transition attack. He is shooting nearly 43% from 3.6 attempts, so we'll keep an eye on the volume. And then, honestly, to me, it hasn't been bad. I want to start with that. It hasn't been as good as I thought it was going to be when he joined Minnesota. Win now situation, lower responsibility on the ball in theory. Like, I thought it was going to be closer to like fringe all defense level. It's just been more solid to me. But wanted to get your thoughts on that. Because looking at what he's done film wise, looking at the box score numbers, and then looking at the on off stuff to where Minnesota's basically been neutral with him on the court, and they've been much better with him off the floor. And this is just filtering for the games that he's played in Minnesota for me per PVV stats. I was like, this feels kind of odd, but I want to see what Steve thought of this. But yeah, I would just like to see Minnesota get and stay healthy, be consistent on both ends, because there is still a Western Conference Finals, if not final ceiling for this group, if they put it together. They just need to put it together. But we are going to take a break from here, and when we return, we shift to the W side, and boy, have we gotten a lot of news so far in this W offseason. I knew that free agency, or just in general this offseason, was going to be a wild and wacky one in light of how late the CBA was ultimately agreed to, the cadet schedule. Like, there's going to be some movement. There are going to be some things that we have to react to. I didn't quite have an Ainge trade on the bingo card. And I especially didn't have an Angel Reese trade on the bingo card to Atlanta on the first day of free agency. Like, we get to Monday, it's like, all right, cool, we're about to get qualifying offers, we're going to get some core designations, maybe we get some more rumbles about players planning on re-signing, but the real fun's going to start on Wednesday. The Sky and the Dream collectively said, well, hold my beverage. We've got a deal for you. Angel Reese, now a member of the Atlanta Dream, her plus second round pick swap rights in 2028, going to the Dream. The Chicago Sky receiving a 2027 first round pick from the Atlanta Dream and a 2028 first round pick from the Atlanta Dream. No players going back to Chicago. And so as I saw that news come through, first reported by Taylor Rooks. Shout out to Taylor Rooks.
Shout out to Taylor Rooks. Now wait. Before you get to your initial thought, I'll sprinkle mine in because I know you are ready to go Usain Bolt style on this trade in particular. But it was weird because I remember over the weekend scrolling and seeing like Alisha Gray and Ryan Howard talking about how Angel Reese looked good in the red jersey. And I was like, well, that's funny. And then the Taylor Rooks tweet happened. And I was like, wait, what's going on here? Do we have shenanigans? Mm-hmm. No, I won't say the word. But it was a lot to process at once. But the floor is yours, Nikias Duncan.
Oh, no. I love/hate that so many of the reactions when big moves happen like this is like, wait, did that come from a real account? Is this like Centel of some sort? Are people playing around on Twitter? so many people are like, I need to verify that this is actually Taylor LaRook's account. It's like, okay, that is her. What the heck is the package now? And then we eventually get the trade package, which I had immediate egg on my face during this. I'm just like, okay, if Angel's going to Chicago, again, we are dealing with virtually the entire league hitting free agency in some kind of way, but you still had Tahina Powell's contract. You still have like draft right situation things. I'm just like, okay, cool. Surely, if the Sky are trading Angel Reese, they're going to get at least three of Tahina Powell, this year's first round pick, which Atlanta drafts 13 overall, or next year's first round pick. And then something else in the tweet. I was like, surely they get at least three of the four things. And then we get the trade details from Andy Constable of Front Office Sports. I was like, ah, so they got one of those things. But they did get the 28 first. And then it just kind of devolved from there for me.
As I was Before you devolve, can I ask one of my questions I had down in my notepad?
Yes.
This is just a thought. Don't jump me. Just thinking out loud here.
Come outside.
I understand the malpractice word is being thrown around. I get the feeling, I get the vibe, I understand. If the Chicago Sky opted not to draft Tahina Powell, who I think is a tremendous player, who had a great year, has a great future, why would they then trade for Tahina Powell to pay her more money?
I think the easy answer to that question, Steve, is that we now have a W sample size for Tahina Powell. And so maybe some of the concerns that Chicago may have had and ultimately led to them not drafting her, maybe some of those were, if not completely solved, you at least feel better about based on the film that Tahina put together last year. That'd be my initial thought to that. But I do understand where the question is coming from on that front. I think for me...
Can I follow up before you go on your rant? Real quick. Just the thought, right? So the Chicago Sky do have the number 5 pick, right? What if we want, you know, not Flage, maybe we want Kiki Rice. Like, what if that's our point guard of the future? We want to pay that. Any credence there?
Lightly, yes. I guess my immediate rebuttal to that would be you don't hurt yourself by having both. Like, even if you feel like Kiki is your point guard of the future, like, in theory, what Kiki does on ball plus what Tahina does as a shooter, there you should have at least some future playing them together. Even if you don't start them together, you should be able to play them together in stretches, in theory, moving forward. And on top of that, like, Chicago isn't ready to compete for a championship right now. So, like, I'm not necessarily as concerned about positional overlap, at least in the guard room right now, as we are trying to build this thing from the ground up. But, again, I do understand, like, the line of thinking. Like, I don't think that's an unfair question to bring up.
Deliver your rant, because you said a thing that I had a thing to say back to it. Go ahead. Go off. Give the people what they want.
This could be a conversation. We can go back and forth.
No. They're just building it from the ground. Here's my thing, right? Overall. I thought that swirls in my mind is with the well-deserved and long overdue increase in the cap and salaries, what does that do to roster construction, right? What are the dominoes that get hit? What's the first domino that falls? Are players looking for short-term deals? Are teams looking for short-term deals? Is it long-term? Does the word sacrifice become a little tastier because of the increase? How do teams value the draft in earnest? Do they value it differently? Or is this going to be status quo to a degree? How much do teams want to spend if this is maybe not their year? And this is a very, 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 very competitive league. Always has been. Now it's growing. And so you can't count on shuffling the deck to a degree. And part of my thought process is, not to defend it, is Nikias, we've seen the Chicago Sky kick the can down the road for how many years? They have kicked a singular can down the road as far as they could take it. There was no more kicking. The Rock could not go any further. It was time for Charlie Brown to miss. And that came at the cost of Angel Reese, who you, in theory, traded up for and is now an Atlanta Dream on top of insert move, on top of insert move. The whole meal doesn't look great. The charcuterie board is in shambles based on everything when you tie it all together. Can't defend that. But at some point, you gotta, this feels like we can't do this anymore. And so I know it's reported Angel Reese didn't request this trade. It was clear how Angel Reese felt about the Chicago Sky situation. And how tenable was that? We'll never know to a degree. But you know what? Before you get to your rant, I'll ask the question.
Okay.
How many teams on April 6th would truly pursue an Angel Reese trade with this amount of players as free agents? Like, if you were in this, if you were in the Sky office, who would your second call have been?
I think in terms of the picks that they have, like, I'm calling Washington. Like, if you have 4, 9, 11, and something else, at the very least, I'm seeing, like,
you sure you're calling them? You sure you're calling them yesterday?
Well, they had some news that we're going to get to as well. But, like, if I'm from the Chicago perspective, at the very least, it's like, okay. Obviously, there was a level of collaboration to where Angel ends up in Atlanta. Because I think if it was purely, we are trading Angel Reese and we're going to get the best possible package, I don't think Atlanta is probably going to be in your top three in terms of what they can offer or what they're going to be willing to offer in a deal, right? But yeah, if I'm calling Atlanta, I'm calling Washington because of the amount of first-round picks that they have. I am calling Connecticut because of what they have and some of the bigs that they have. So if we did just want to still maintain a level of young, cost-controlled, big man depth, and also maybe some pick equity, I'll call Connecticut for sure. You've already had conversations with both of the expansion teams. So at least see, like, are you willing to do anything with, if not this first-round pick next week? I would imagine the answer is no, considering, hey, the 27 draft class may include some really special talent. And if we have a bad year one, we're going to be in position to not draft sixth and seventh. We could be in, we could have the number one pick. We don't really want to mess it up. So maybe it's a no, but I at least make those calls and have those conversations. And so I think you could bounce around quite a bit, honestly, with this, because Angel is such a unique talent who is, again, cost control. And because she hasn't made an all-W team, at least not yet, you're not even dealing with the similar bit to where, like, Leah Boston or Caitlin Clark, where they've made all-W, they're going to have contract exculators before their rookie contract goes out. You don't have to deal with that with Angel yet. Yeah, like, I want to see how can I maximize this if this is the button that we're ultimately going to press.
Okay. And so, again, before Nikias, you get to your bars, do you think the Atlanta Dream were motivated to get Angel Reese in this scenario? Obviously, the fit market-wise speaks for itself. But if you look at what the Dream did last year on both ends of the court, the Bree Jones, Brittany Griner dynamic, the duo, what if we just meld that into Angel Reese? Because I think that Angel Reese can do all of those things. Defensively, we've seen growth, can switch, can hit different coverages, can put two on the ball. We trust that. But then offensively, hey, we have someone we can go inverted pick and roll with. We have someone we can play through the elbow with. We can throw it in the post. We can blame this guy, and I'm sure you will. But how much of this do you think was the Atlanta Dream saying, let's knock on this door and see if we just offer these two picks, if we can get a player that fits into what Carl Smesko wants to do? Because for what people doubt with Angel Reese, the rebounding speaks for itself. The growth playmaking-wise speaks for itself. I think the attacks and being able to be a screener, a roller, the defense, being able to defend multiple positions, there's a good fit here. So we can curse this guy out if we'd like. But did the Dream just kind of say, hey, I think we could do something here?
I think absolutely. So I think this is where I'm interested to see what reporting comes out or even what I could potentially find out on that front in terms of who reached out to who. Because I think, as you alluded to earlier, like, no, maybe Angel and her team didn't directly say, hey, I would like to be traded. Let's do something. I will say, I think both sides are in a place where it's like, it's probably best if we move forward elsewhere. And let's see if we can work together to figure this out so this does not linger into the off season or linger into this next regular season, lingers into training camp, which we were like a week and a half away from, by the way. Let's see if we can pull something off. In Atlanta, like, yeah, we could add Angel Reese to our core without giving up any of our rookie scale or draft right folks. Without giving up any of our top players. Yes, if we have the opportunity to do that, let's go ahead and do that. And we keep our first round pick for this year too, so we can add another young talent that we may be intrigued by, or maybe that's a trade up situation. Maybe that's a trade back and get a future pick situation to replenish what we just gave up in Angel Deal. Like, they still have a level of optionality. So this is where, like, before even seeing the on-court fit with Angel Reese, where I agree with a lot of what you said, her use as a hub, inverted pick and rolls, the rebounding on both ends of the floor, the defense versatility, all of those things make this a good move for Atlanta outright. The fact that they were able to pull this off without giving up, I don't want to say anything of consequence because those are still just two first-round picks, but we didn't give up our best stuff and pull this off. Like, it's an A trade just off principle. And that's before getting into any of the off-court effects where you've already seen ticket prices rising, a whole bunch of celebrities like, well, I'm going to Atlanta, yada, yada, yada. Like, Atlanta's already won this before we ship back to the Chicago Sky. So, yeah.
Before I let you go in on the Sky, I have another alternate thought. This is not how this is supposed to go, by the way, public. This is supposed to go completely different. I just want that to be known. I think for me, it gets interesting if you think about the Chicago Sky only solely in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. Not stacking all the moves. How could they enter free agency where a whole lot of players are available and answer the Angel Reese question truthfully? How much do you think that could have factored into, we need to do this now, we need to rip the band-aid off? Like, regardless of what you think about the package that returned, not arguing that, how much is it we are not going to be able to have these conversations to get to our next part of what we're trying to do, where we're tearing this down to a degree, if every player or every agent to be like, what's going on? What's going on over here?
Yeah, I would say, just frankly, I think that was probably the primary motivator of this deal being done when it was. I think they flat out wanted to be like, okay, whether you feel better about our situation or worse about our situation, at the very least, you know what our situation is now. And so I can now have these conversations with agents. I can have these conversations with players. Like, this is the slate. This is what we have. These are the rookie scale players that we have. We have Camilla Cardoso, who is just going to be the unquestioned top front court piece that we have. And this is how we feel like your skill set can match with her and how we want to grow with her, et cetera. Like, the coaching staff is locked in. Front office, for last I heard at the very least, is locked in. This is what we are building from. Can you help us take our next steps? It is a much easier conversation to have. Now, again, to your point, like, you can argue if it is a better conversation or a better path versus a week ago. But at the very least, there is a lot more clarity in Chicago, and it makes it easier for them to see what is realistic about what we can build with and how we can build this thing out moving forward. Now, to the Chicago side, I was in a headlock with this as we got the trade package. And the more that I thought about it, and then ultimately the more that I talked to people like close to the situation there and things like that, I ultimately landed closer to where I was with the Luka Doncic trade, to where I now have a better understanding and a stronger understanding of the logic that led to, we have to trade our best young player or our best player. We have to do it, regardless of if I agree or disagree. Ultimately, I have a much better understanding of why they felt they had to do this. I then get into phase two, and it's like, okay, if you are going to do this, again, I believe, cannot confirm this, but I believe there was a level of collaboration and Atlanta was probably at the top of the list and they got that done. In the event that it was anything less than that, you owe it to yourself as an organization to be like, hey, even if it's just a back channel thing, hey, Angel Reese is available. We need to have some sort of bidding war. Even if it still ends up being Atlanta, it goes from 27 first and 28 first to 27 first, 28 first, rights to Isabel Barlace, et cetera, right? like, I think you have to extract more from Atlanta in this deal if you do your due diligence and you ask around, like, okay, what can we get here, 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 and here? Even if Atlanta's number one on the list and it ends up being Atlanta's spot. So, like, that part bothered me. And as much as you've layered out the context, Steve, when you've been framing these questions, and I appreciate it, it is very difficult for me not to look at what the last 5 years for the Chicago Sky has been like. And look at this situation. You can go further. Like, you can go even further. But, like, you know, Sylvia Fowles, Leonard Dillon, you can go even further. But, like, it's hard to look at this in particular and be like, what on earth is happening at the very top? Forget the coaching. Forget the front office. What is happening with ownership to where this keeps happening and these moves keep being layered the way that they do? We went from Chicago Sky, wait, their record is what? They won ship anyway, into, oh my goodness, they're going back to the finals. The Connecticut Sun said absolutely not, to everybody left in 2023. We are now hiring new names in the front office and things. James Wade left in the middle of the season. Okay, we got to clean house. We got to do all this. It's cool. Then we had the Marina Maybe trade, where you give up, I believe, 5 total picks in that deal, plus the rights to Leonie Feverish. I can't hammer home too much on the Leonie Feverish part, because that's very much a hindsight 2020 bit. But it's like, how did we get there? And it's like, okay, we get to the Wetherspoon.
He brought it back. Keep going.
No, but like, okay, we have the Marina deal, which, again, that happened before Jeff got there. So, like, he's not responsible for that one if you're talking about just the GM. But, like, overall ownership of things. Like, okay, we have this deal. Like, okay, that's not ideal. You hire Teresa Weatherspoon before you hire your GM. And I tweeted immediately, I don't love that you have hired your head coach before you got your front office in place. Not that it can't work, but I don't really love the order of operations there. We get the Angel Reese trade up. Angel's there. You have the year on Teresa Weatherspoon. You get all the reporting at the end of the year about players not being sure what the role is, whatever fracas you want to believe out of that situation. Teresa Weatherspoon's gone after a year. It's like, okay. Don't really love that, but I understand how you get there. You hire Tyler Marsh. It's like, okay. We're going to build this more slowly, right? We have Camilo Cardoso. We have Angel Reese. We have a new coach that we're giving a long-term deal to. We're going to build this thing up. We're going to be intentional about how we're building it. But we're going to try to build something sustainable. Nope, we are trading the number 3 pick of the draft for Ariel Atkins. And we're doing that. We are also giving up swap rights in 2027 to our first round pick. And so now, if the Sky are bad, they have virtually no chance at having the number 1 pick in the 27 draft, because the Mystics can just be like, yeah, we'll just take that, actually. That is going to be fine. And then that flows into the Angel Reese deal, which, again, I have a better understanding of why I think both sides felt like we need to make a move. But I don't think you got as much as you could have gotten from that situation. And if there was genuinely open bidding everywhere, I think the price in the overall packages would have been better almost by default if you open that up in a real way. And so it's hard for me to not look at the ownership group that has shepherded multiple head coaches, multiple front office decision makers across this stretch. And it's like, what are you doing? What kind of environment are you fostering? What kind of decision-making are you allowing to where you continue to stack all of these things? And now you're adding to the history of star or future star players leaving your organization earlier than they have to. Like, this is not just trading Angel Reese. Angel Reese is off of year 2 of her rookie-scaled contract. For that alone, Steve, 2 more years of team control plus whatever extension you get there, or she has restricted free agents. Like, you have 6 or 7 years at minimum of control, of contract control with Angel Reese. And you were punting after year 2, and you only got 2 firsts to show for it. And you gave up a pick swap in that deal on top of that. How are you trading Angel Reese and a pick swap?
Well, it's, I mean, I think one thing I would say, a lot of decisions and directives do come from the top. And we don't necessarily have all the information as to why or when or how, but there is some times where the top says, get this done, and it gets done. So who knows? I just, for me, I'm just, if we're doing the WNBA transfer portal to a degree, with the draft in less than a week, as much as I value Angel Reese the talent, I have a plan that I'm trying to execute if I'm most teams, right? So I'm the Connecticut Sun. Sure, I'd love Angel Reese. That'd be great, especially if we're moving to Houston. But we have bigs, and we're doing something different, right? I'm Dallas Wings. I have the number one pick. I would not like to talk to anyone for a little bit because I want to figure that out and get it done. If I'm Golden State, hey, we just were able to protect most of them too, and we still lost people. No, I don't want to do stuff. You know, well, the Ace is going to call, the Sparks. I have Cam Brink and Rickia Jackson. I'm good. On the Minnesota Lynx, I have the number two. I'm fine. I'm good. Liberty, I've gotten everyone to come back. Phoenix Mercury, I'm trying to get everyone to come back. Washington Mystics, yeah, I heard you, but we just got a little bit better to a degree. So I think I understand Atlanta's motivation for this. I think I understand Chicago understanding they had to get it done. We can't imagine the market to a degree, but it takes two to dance, takes two to tango. And if you get in a scenario, it's like, I don't know if I want the player. I definitely want the pick. I have to get this done. This is where we're at. It's a restart for Chicago. So it's a full restart for Chicago to the degree of we have to go forward. Mm.
That's ultimately where they landed. You mentioned the Aces. It would have been cool if they had a 27 first round pick. Wonder what happened to that. But it is
what did happen to that?
Fascinating.
No, you don't want to talk about that. Continue on.
But no. Fascinating move with obvious ripple effects across the league. At recording this on a Tuesday morning, we're actually going to get legit free agency movement starting on Wednesday. So I don't know what we're going to be reacting to on Friday when things really open up fully, but this is one heck of a way to kick things off. So we'll see what Chicago's plan is going to be. I would imagine they're going to major swings with some vets to kind of accelerate things and build things out around Camilo Cardoso. So we'll see who they have in mind on that front. Some interesting names have popped up, but we'll see how much Chicago's able to land. In Atlanta, oh boy, as I tweeted, and I'll close it there, we shift to some of the other W news. Late fourth quarter, Alisha Gray, Ryan Howard, Angel Reese, and Naz Hillman could be on the floor together at once. Good luck scoring. It doesn't matter who your fifth is at that point. Good luck scoring on that group when you have all four of them on the floor together. That defense is going to be nasty. This rebounding group, you're adding Angel to that. This is already a high free throw rate team. You're adding Angel to that. She helps this dream team quite a bit.
Well, we got to see what the full dream team is. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that is true. We got to piece some things together.
That we do. I'll quickly say, shout out to Angel and just her team, just having all this together. That trade is announced, and it felt like 45 minutes later. Here's a whole photo shoot. We've got promotional things to say. Like they had that together. Her team always has things a lot. So like I chuckled at it a little bit, but I do genuinely respect like how that all came together and how quickly they were ready to brand Angel in Atlanta. That is going to be a fun time. Now, as we move forward, we are fresh off of expansion things, Steve. We have the expansion rosters. How did you feel about how the draft went, how it was presented? Were there any surprises for you during the expansion draft situation or context, rather?
I didn't have an issue. I mean, I think everything's condensed to a degree. And one, happy the Fire and Temple are here. Two, happy to see what kind of base they can get on as far as which players they would like to, what philosophy they want to attach to. Like, again, there's a lot of how many of these players will be on the roster to a degree. But that part's done. We can start arguing about a list that we'll never, ever, ever see, ever, 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 ever. And so I was intrigued. I was intrigued by the fact that Bridget Carlton was the number one pick from the Portland Fire. But based on the comments from the GM, it makes a lot of sense as far as why they would pursue Bridge and kind of build a base around, but understand the importance of having a player of that caliber with what they want to do. So having a Bridget Carlton, being able to add a Carla Late, being able to add a Shook Sutton, potentially having a Sarah Ashley Barker. I feel like they had a type of player. They wanted versatility in the forward room, being able to get a big like Louisa. Like they just wanted skilled talent that fits into what they want to build going forward. So I thought that was interesting. With Toronto, big thing for me, and I got yelled at, I got booed. I told you Marina Mabry may be unprotected. And I thought that was a big swing from the Toronto Tempo to say, hey, we're trying to make a splash and make something happen and be impactful. Marina Mabry, come on down. Because while people may say Marina Mabry is of a certain caliber, that is a bucket getter, that is a playmaker, and that is something that we can now add to our program and build around to a degree. And so Marina, especially, you know, being, I think, you know, she wasn't the first or second pick for them, but adding Marina had to be a win for Toronto. And so you can kind of see the versatility aspect, trying to get some size, trying to get some switchability, getting different kind of bigs. When you look at Klundikova and Nyara Sabali, being able to have Julie Alamand and what she brings to the table on both of the floor with Lexi Held, like you can kind of see Aaliyah and I, what they want to have in their programs. And I think this is where the growth of the W will get interesting, because these teams are going to be able to build identities from the start. I don't think everyone's going to do what Golden State did last year. Shout out to Natalie Nakase. I don't think that's going to happen. But we're going to have what we want to do, the type of players we want to add, and we're going to get to the chicken right away. And so that's where it gets interesting. Again, got to see who they draft, got to see who they're able to sign, but you get philosophy from both of these teams. And so I was impressed with both of them as far as just kind of stamping what they wanted and how they wanted to get to it.
I think that's a great way to frame that, like looking at the versatility of Portland and looking at still skill size in Toronto, but like felt like more of an emphasis on, we want to make sure we have players that can knock down shots from the perimeter to really build this thing out. We do have good front court passes. We've got good front court screeners on top of that, so we can unlock things on and off the ball. To your point, we do have to have the entire draft free agency period, but like it was cool to see that come together. I guess for me, I want to zoom out and circle back to some of the, I guess, perceived protections heading into the expansion draft about surprises versus like biggest takeaways. We can start with Marina, to where when we had our conversation on the pod, I said my four firm would have been Layla Lacan, Saniya Rivers, Anissa Morrow, Aaliyah Edwards. And you have the conversation with, okay, are we protecting Marina Mabry, or do we make the gamble that we could leave her unprotected and maybe bring her back? And Toronto's like, nah, I think we will take Marina Mabry. That is fine. And so Connecticut keeping their young players is interesting to me. The Marina gamble, if it was a gamble, lends with her in Toronto. So I'm fascinated to see how Toronto continues to build things out around her. She may be the best player on the roster right now. I don't know if they want her to be overall, but that's going to be a fun one. Can I talk about the Las Vegas Aces very quickly? Is that a thing I'm carefully allowed to do on this here podcast? Carefully. Carefully indeed.
Hey, producer, get me out the camera shot. Thank you.
That's crazy. Steve calling for the one shot is insane. And I'm actually in the one shot. That's podcast power right there. We talked about it on the pod. I ultimately wrote a piece given my protection predictions and whatnot. And I figured Aaliyah and I on a rookie contract, I think she's going to be safe. And considering that they had Kate Martin on a rookie contract last year ahead of the Golden State Valkyries expansion draft, I don't think they want to lose young wing that is you have a level of team. Do that 2 years in a row. And I'll be, if I'm not watching the expansion draft special on ESPN, and Aaliyah and I pops up. I'm just like, wait, there's no way they did this again. I can't believe they did this again. And after thinking more about it, go ahead. You're back in the shot now. What's going on?
Well, the guys, if you shenan once, then you'll shenan again. You'll shenan again.
Yeah, I guess you will. There's no way you're proud of that. Okay. Well, I was like, there's no way you do that. So as I thought more about it, I think it is clear that the Aces, one, prioritized the restricted free agents they had in both Nelissa Smith and Kirsten Bell, in addition to their big three. That'd be my guess at the very least. But I think looking at what free agency can be for them heading into literally tomorrow, if you do lose Aaliyah Nye, you now just have the full $7 million to work with. Heading into this free agency period, like you just have nobody on the roster at the moment. And so you can really mold this thing and build around your Asia Jackie Chelsea core in however way you see fit. And so removing the rookie scale, like the bump up that Aaliyah and I got and all the other rookies in the W got, like it does free up a little bit more salary in a roster spot. So like I could get the logic behind that. And even then, I kind of circle back to, if your plan ultimately was not to keep Aaliyah Nye long term, but you can argue the merits of that if you want, I would still protect her. And then, like, we get to draft day, can we get a second round pick for her? Or can we get, like, I think you had her under contract. You had more room to at least dictate how you lost her at bare minimum. And so I still kind of found the level of, like, why not protect her to move her later versus just letting her walk type beat. So that was a surprise to me. So we got the Marina surprise. We got the Aaliyah Nye surprise. And now look at the Los Angeles Sparks. That Julie Alamon, one, just one of the most impactful players for the Sparks last year. We'll look at on-off stuff, but just in general, her playmaking and decision-making, her defense in key moments also just popped for them in the second half of the year. So good player, really good selection. I was just kind of expecting between Azaree Stevens and Ray Burrell, like one of them would be elsewhere, because I didn't think you could protect Kelsey and De'Erica and Rekia and Cam, and then like both of them, like you could only protect up to five. And so for both of them to still technically be safe, or at the very least they were safe from the expansion draft, like that was also a surprise for me. I think those are probably the larger ones for me. And then Dallas, like they just had so many players that you could choose from that are on rookie scale deals or have some kind of team control. So I was curious to see like where they would land in terms of protection. So seeing Haley Jones and Luisa Geisler-Soto to be the two players selected, was like, okay, so they must have prioritized the guard then. JJ Quinterly, Isaiah James, et cetera. So like that was an interesting one for me as well.
You didn't listen to me when we did the expansion exercise. You didn't absorb anything I said. You didn't believe anything I said. You didn't. I told you no. Sparks is going nowhere, man. I told you that.
You did say that.
I sure like, did.
The route raised a little bit. That's all. Go ahead.
I think the biggest thing for me is like Portland's mission was loud to me when you have Haley Jones, Chloe Bibby, and Emily Inksler. Like, okay, I understand what you're trying to do. But it'll be interesting to see how these teams kind of come together, especially as free agency unfolds, especially as money dries up, especially as sacrifices are made to be on teams. Like, again, roster construction could get very interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Quickly on the news front while we're still here. The Washington Mystics, as we kind of alluded to earlier, we brought up as we talked about Angel Reese and potential landing spots outside of Atlanta. The Washington Mystics firing their GM, Jamela Wideman, after one season. ESPN's Alexa Philippou had the report on that, had an article ready. Some key nuggets from that piece. The decision was made by Monumental president of basketball, Michael Winger, and was a direct of serious strategic differences, elite source told ESPN. The misaligned visions became more apparent as the team geared up for free agency. That was interesting to me. In relation to Wideman no longer having a job, head coach Sidney Johnson will assume control of basketball operations, and we'll see in the future if they ultimately want to add a GM, but it seems he's going to be taking on more of the decision-making power there. And last thing for me from the piece that stood out, as free agency tips off this week, negotiations can begin Wednesday, the Mystics are looking to surround their young players with higher-level proven talent, a source said. So that circles back to the opening quote about serious strategic differences. And my immediate question, and one that I'll pose to you, Steve, is do we think this is an instance of we want to accelerate the timeline because of how good we were last year or how much better we were than expected last year, and we have this free agency period, let's add some vets, let's take another step? And maybe Jamela Wideman is like, well, let's continue to build this more methodically. Do you feel like that could be the friction, or is there anything else do you feel like could lead to something like this? Because serious strategic differences feels pretty loud in this case.
I mean, number one, shout out to Stanford number 10, Jamela Wideman. Always. Now, to that, we kind of do this thing where we speculate on information that we have no idea about. And this just could have been a power struggle to a degree where it may not be about selling a rebuild. It may be about a single player. And if we're misaligned on that, okay, I'm going to grab this power to a degree, or this is going to change and alter this. Like there's the dynamics and the politics of basketball front offices are different to a degree because you're never going to know the true answer, the true reason on why something occurred. And so for me, it's a fruitless exercise to a degree because we don't know. we don't know who decided what. We don't know what it was. But the fact that it said serious strategic differences doesn't necessarily mean to me automatically one side wants to go swing for the fences and the other doesn't. Because I think if you're in the W and you're the Mystics and you have accumulated this amount of young talent, you can add more. Obviously, you're going to try and get some additional players. It just speaks to something went left as far as what the plan was long term. So I wouldn't attach it necessarily to, well, now I want to build to the draft. How many teams have truly, 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 truly sat in the W and said, I'd like to build to the draft? It's a 2-year record. How many teams have really wanted to do that? So it's different. I don't think it's that. And I feel like we've seen a lot of teams be comfortable swinging the bat to add a piece. You know, we saw Connecticut add Marina Mabry. And Marina Mabry was like, hey, can I leave? And Connecticut was like, no, you can't.
No.
Like,
but Natasha Cloud got
not. No. It's not unusual for teams to try and add talent plus their young talent because we want to be the best we can be. Whatever that was, I don't know. But I don't necessarily think it's the discussion that's being had.
Okay. That's fair. I figured I'd get your thoughts as someone that's like actually worked in like a professional front office and things. Like, okay, do you have more that you got to shed on that front? Maybe not that specific situation, but just like how these kind of things unfold. Because reading against serious strategic differences, like, okay, for me, it's really, this is just not, I think George Amore is this and you think George Amore is that. You get into serious, I feel like there's a philosophical difference between the two. So, you know, maybe we get more reporting out of Washington at some point to get a better answer. Maybe we just never find out, to your point. But that one caught me by surprise. I thought she did a tremendous job in her 1 year in Washington and has helped them be very well situated for the future moving forward. Again, heading into next week's draft, 4th pick, 9th pick, I think 11th pick and 13th pick, where at least 4, 9, and 11, that they can select 3 different players, they can consolidate however you want to do it, and they also just have Sonya Citron, Kiki Arioff, and like you just have a really good foundation to build on. So we'll see what happens with Washington this week and moving forward. Other quick hitters in terms of news, Asia Wilson has publicly stated, like, yeah, I'm coming back to Vegas. I'm where I'm supposed to be. Talked a little bit earlier about the Aces planning on being a team that's going to offer her a Supermax. I would imagine she accepts that. That's a lot of money. But Asia also saying, yeah, I want to be in Vegas. Not a surprise, but that is out there. The New York Liberty, Steve. As we talked about free agency in the lead up a week or so ago, it's like, hey, I feel like if there's going to be movement, I'm keeping an eye on Jonquel Jones. She could maybe be the biggest domino that could fall in this case. But Breonna Stewart announced on her podcast, I'm back. Sabrina Ionescu during Team USA camp says, I'm back. Jackie Powell of Forts reporting that Jonquel Jones plans to be back. So the Liberty have their big three. Are you excited about the New York Liberty bringing their big three back under new coaching? And in general, I guess, what would you like to see them aim for in free agency to round their core out?
Got to hit the margins. I think you want to have more versatility, have a blend of size, have some shooting, be able to defend different lineups. But yeah, let's do what we do. We have a proven product. Let's improve on it.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Excited to see Benai Delaney Hamilton back at some point.
Are you excited for the Liberty coming back? I feel like that's an important question.
Yes. Like, I think this is a very good trio. They have won a championship together. And I'm curious to see, like, what Chris DeMarco does with this group and how that differs from what Sandy Brondello did. Like, this is why I thought Jonquel Jones was going to be an interesting domino in this, decide to return or go elsewhere. Because her usage has kind of been a source of friction in New York. Sometimes heavy post touches, sometimes just a lot of spacing for her. She's been trying to find her way. So I'm curious to see, like, now that we know all three of them are coming back, I'm ready to see preseason action with them. But those three, Leone Feverish is still there, but Nigel Laney Hamilton comes back. Like, that is an elite starting five.
Yeah, you get the lineup back. And if they can keep Natasha Cloud, oh, buddy, it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we leave, are you ready for the Seattle Storm to become the Seattle partly
cloudy. This week, that is, in the rumor mill, likely that Neka Ogunbowale and Skylar Diggins are elsewhere next year. Like, that is not a thing that had on the bingo card. I figured you have those two back, and maybe it's, okay, what happens with Ezzie Mabigore? What happens with Brittany Sykes? To a lesser extent, what happens to Gabby Williams? Though I think, I would imagine she's back as well. If those two leave, I am fascinated for what that looks like. Like, I immediately think what the Skylar in Minnesota look like, especially depending on what Minnesota does with the number two pick of the draft. Like, if they go big, like, do you get Skylar in the point guard room to upgrade there? There are a lot of different places Skylar fits, for sure. And with NECA, she's still so good. So incredibly good. I have some ideal landing spots for NECA Ogunwusi, but for the interest of time and for the people that I care about in my life, I'm not going to do that on this podcast. Maybe we do it on Friday. But thank you to those who listened and or watched this episode of the Dunker Spot Podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Plenty of great content dropping on the channel daily. And we're there every Tuesday and Friday, so you want to make sure you're rocking with us as well. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.